This is an ABC podcast.
There are a lot of unique things about this year's Olympics. Millions of Japanese people don't actually want the Tokyo Games to go ahead, and plenty of athletes and volunteers have been dropping out in the lead-up too.
A day of high drama on three continents has left the Australian Olympic team in shock and without two of its biggest stars. Tennis player Alex de Minaur has COVID and has been ruled out. And our highest-profile women's basketballer Liz Cambage has quit the Games.
The star said she was terrified of heading into the Olympic bubble, in a statement saying, "The past month I've been having panic attacks, not sleeping, not eating."
Aside from the pandemic though, these also happen to be the first Games with a transgender person competing in them.
New Zealand weightlifter Laurel Hubbard is set to become the first transgender athlete to compete at the Olympics. The country's Olympic Committee has named her as part of the women's team for the Tokyo Games.
It is a big step, but access is still a long way from being guaranteed at any level of sport.
You know, technically they can just say, nope, sorry, no trans woman allowed ever. There are sports that do that.
I'm Angela Voipierre, and today on The Signal, we speak to trans athletes about what's fair and what's not in elite sport.
My name is Chelsea Wolf. I am a BMX freestyle rider from the United States.
So Chelsea Wolf is a woman at the very top of her game, so much so that she's made the cut to go to the Olympics. She is going as an alternate, which is something that I had to look up, but it's more or less what it sounds like, a kind of athletic understudy. The thing is, even that wouldn't have been allowed in the past. For starters, BMX only became an Olympic sport back in 2008, but also Chelsea is a trans woman, so competing comes with an extra set of rules.
I started BMX riding in the year 2000 with BMX racing. It was just before my 7th birthday, and did that for pretty much my whole childhood up until I was 21, I think, is when I've done my most recent race.
People who like find their sport or like find their musical instrument that early in life, it kind of turns into an obsession pretty quickly. Was that what it was like for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been my entire life for my whole life, so I couldn't imagine life without it, really.
How old were you when you realized that you were a trans woman?
So it actually took a little while before I was able to get over the internalized transmisogyny that I had, to be able to kind of like claim like, yes, I am a trans woman, without like feeling like that was a bad thing, you know, because like we have so many just subtle teachings in our media that tells us that being trans is gross and bad and all these just horrible things. So it was at some point in my teens, but I definitely knew that I was struggling with gender dysphoria from my earliest memories as a kid.
Whereas coming out and being affirmed took longer.
So there's actually no exact date. That's the thing with coming out, is it's like never just a one and done, like happened on this day and it's over. It's a constant process, really. And, you know, there were people who I came out to at an extremely young age, like close friends of mine. And then it wasn't until years later that, you know, I kind of was at a point where I didn't have to fear who I ran into out and about.
Representing Florida, USA, Chelsea Wolf!
Fast, very fast. Pump jump into the ball. Yeah, that transfer out to the volcano.
You've had some really extraordinary success in your career in BMX, and all of this has happened at the same time that there's been this wave of bills targeting trans people in the US, in your home country, and in recent years many of them targeting sports specifically.
It's been a record-breaking year of bills proposed in state legislatures that would limit transgender rights, from access to medical care to sports participation.
At least 24 states are considering bills to stop certain transgender students from being a part of their high school and college athletics programs.
Have you ever been worried that your participation would be banned or interfered with in some way?
Oh, completely, yeah. Because that's the thing, is these organizations that are creating the rules for like when, where, and how trans people are allowed to compete in sports, those boards are mostly made up, if not entirely made up, of cis people. So they can just shift the goalposts or completely get rid of the goalposts altogether for us at any moment. So it's kind of a scary thing to live with. And then also it's just really hard to see that kind of thing being done to kids who are just like I was when I was their age, just trying to exist and play sports with their friends, and then having that taken from them by people who are just scared and don't know what they're doing.
So if all that sounds paranoid, all you need to do is look at the recent history of the rules for trans athletes. So all the way up to 2004, trans people were banned from the Olympics altogether, but then the IOC changed the rules so that trans people could take part, but only under three strict conditions. First, athletes had to have undergone sex reassignment surgery, including changes in the external genitalia. Second, athletes must have received legal recognition of their gender and be able to prove that. And third, they had to have been on hormone therapy for 2 years. All the while, the trans community, people like American runner Chris Mosier, a trans man, were pushing for change. And in 2015, they got it.
In preparation for Rio, the International Olympics Committee relaxed its guidelines for transgender athletes.
The Olympic Committee changed the rules again, citing concerns that their stance insisting on surgery was inconsistent with human rights principles. Now, the new guidelines require only that trans women athletes declare their gender and not change that assertion for 4 years, as well as demonstrate a testosterone level of less than 10 nanomoles per litre for at least 1 year prior to competition and throughout the period of eligibility. Athletes who transitioned from female to male are allowed to compete without restriction. These guidelines were in effect for the 2016 Rio Olympics, although no openly transgender athletes competed. Which brings us to 2020. And the weightlifter Laurel Hubbard.
A New Zealand weightlifter is set to become the first transgender athlete to compete at the upcoming Tokyo Olympics.
She was selected for the New Zealand team in the women's super heavyweight 87 plus kilogram category. And everyone seems to have an opinion on whether or not that is fair.
Critics argue that she has an unfair advantage over biological women.
Rules that are set by sporting bodies.
It's not fair, is it?
By governing bodies.
It's just not fair.
No, but you've got to make sure it is fair.
It's damaging to women's rights.
Because if you've gone through a male puberty, the chances are that you will be bigger. You will have a longer reach. You will have a greater stride, which gives you that inherent advantage.
Laurel's body does not produce testosterone, so she is competing in a complete androgen-deprived state.
The IOC president, Thomas Bach, has an opinion too. He has backed her selection, saying that under the current rules, she can compete. But he added that those rules are under review.
You cannot change rules during an ongoing competition. At the same time, the IOC is in an inquiry phase with all the different stakeholders. The medical experts, social experts, human rights experts, and of course also international federations, to review these rules.
How common are trans athletes now on an international stage?
Look, still not that common, given how much news we hear about it, and most of that news is in opposition to particularly transgender women competing in female sport. There's been a lot of coverage on that. There's not a high number of people, and especially if you're talking about the elite of the elite, we're talking about 1% of 1%, and then talking about 1% of people who might be, you know, identifying as transgender. So it's a very, very small number.
Tracy Holmes is a senior sports reporter for the ABC, and she's covering the Tokyo Olympic Games for us. And again, there are clear rules in place for the Olympics specifically, but when you start looking at individual sports outside that competition, it's a lot patchier.
It's a big mess, actually, because every sport has its own rules and every sport takes its direction from the International Federation. And then the International Federation might issue a set of standards, and then each country kind of says, oh, no, but we have a different set of standards. So all of those sort of internal battles are taking place at a sports governance level. But we're seeing, you know, pretty much across the board in a lot of sports, we see transgender men and women that are coming through, especially as they start to feel more comfortable and as society start to open up more. But again, that very much depends on a country-by-country basis and a sport-by-sport basis.
When did we start to see this issue flare up in sporting regulation? Where and when can we trace it back to?
There was a woman in Canada. Her name is Kristen Worley. She was a cyclist and perhaps one of the first that really very strongly documented all the changes that took place in her body and how she performed as she transitioned. And her doctors were also very thorough in that, and they had this body of work, and they actually took the International Cycling Union to the Human Rights Tribunal in Canada. And this also brought in the IOC regulations and a number of other parties, and they've been forced to address it from, you know, the early kind of just post 2010. This is where the IOC has become a lot more active, and because of the IOC looking at this, it's forced all of the other international sports bodies that are affiliated with the IOC to start looking at their own policies and coming up with a better body of work that addresses how society is changing.
What do we know about the science of what happens to a trans woman after they have transitioned and, you know, they're on hormonal therapy? What happens to their competitiveness and that natural advantage that critics of opening up sports to trans people often talk about?
So there is some debate in the science, there's no doubt about that. But essentially, if you speak to trans athletes themselves and the lived experience of these people at elite level, what happens is, it's, if you can explain it this way, I think this is the most simple way of understanding it. So absolutely, traditionally, they tend to be taller, bigger frames, have developed more muscle because they've had, you know, 13, 14, 15, 25, depending when you transition, years of male testosterone levels and the body developing to a male physique, which is very different to a female physique. So they have, you know, power, they've got strength, they've got speed, they've got all of these advantages. When they go on hormone treatment, the hormones are reduced to such a level, if they want to compete in sport, it's got to be below 10 nanomoles per litre. For some sports, it's below 5 nanomoles per litre. That reduces the capacity of your body and how it's functioning inside to be able to power that body. So, for instance, Hannah Mounsey, who was an AFL player and I think still plays AFL at a community level, but the AFL body would not let her compete at the elite level because they said they were still debating this science and they thought, you know, the power-to-weight ratio was going to give her too much of an advantage against the players she was up against. Now, her experience actually in playing in Canberra at a club level there is that her body no longer has the capacity to be able to move at speed to carry the strength and the size and the height of that body forward. So when she comes into a clash, it's more likely she's the one to go down. It's more likely she's the one that's going to get injured. So it's like a car. You can say, okay, so let's say there's a Porsche and there's a Mazda and you want to race the two. There's no doubt who's going to win that race. But if the Porsche does not have any fuel and the Mazda's completely fueled up, then the Mazda's going to win. Mm. And that's the kind of scenario we're talking about.
So the conventional wisdom at a regulatory level seems to be that the science is not settled, but the IOC at least believes that it's settled enough for trans people to compete in these games.
It's a lot more progressive than we've seen in the past, and so that's a very big step. And the IOC is still working on this. They have one of their committees that is constantly reviewing this. They had said that there was going to be a fairly substantial announcement before the Tokyo Olympic Games, but because of the delay in the Tokyo Olympics and all of the work that they've had to kind of just take away from everywhere else and dedicate to COVID, they've delayed this response. But there is supposedly quite a substantial announcement coming from the IOC sometime after Tokyo with regard to transgender athletes.
And do we have any sense of which direction they might be heading in?
Well, I think it's a very positive direction, actually, because you remember we've got all sorts of other bodies that are now feeding into this conversation. And as society makes a shift away from this very binary male-female scenario, and as different scientific and medical proof comes out, then sports bodies really need to take those sorts of things into account. And they've worked very closely with Kristen Worley, who I mentioned earlier, the Canadian cyclist. Mm-hmm. They've been looking at the science, and they've also had a shift inside the IOC, which is also quite significant in recent years, and that is they have signed on to a human rights charter. And so they are looking at it through a human rights prism a lot more than they have in the past.
So Tracy thinks this issue is moving in one direction, and this big decision, when it's handed down after the Tokyo Games, is likely to maintain or improve access for trans athletes rather than dramatically restrict it. But when I asked Chelsea Wolfe the same question, she was a lot less willing to take an outcome like that for granted, which is understandable given how much she has riding on it.
You know, technically they can just say, nope, sorry, no trans woman allowed ever. There are sports that do that. And, you know, they don't really tell us or even hint at what their plans are. So, I mean, to hold that over our heads for over a year at this point, saying like, hey, we're going to change the goalposts on you, but we won't tell you what it is, as we're supposed to try to be focusing on being the best at our craft. Like, if we're talking unfair advantages, putting that on our conscience is what now?
So again, that might sound pessimistic or maybe even paranoid, but you might have heard her say that there are some sports that have banned trans women from elite levels of international competition. One of them is rugby.
My name is Grace McKenzie. I'm a rugby player in San Francisco. I run operations for a startup company here in the Bay Area.
And Grace is not a professional, but she loves this game.
This was about a year after I had come out, started hormones, what have you. I was at a tech conference in San Francisco called Lesbians Who Tech. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a tech conference for queer women and folks in the technology industry. And I was at the after party. It was a Sunday, and I got there right as the bar opened. And I remember I walked in and I made eye contact with this person across the bar, really sort of like dashing looking person, denim jacket, undercut, cool glasses. And they like made eye contact with me, waltzed over with a beer, sat down, put it in front of me. And the first words out of their mouth were, my name is Indigo. Do you want to play rugby with me? And I looked at them and I was like, this is really not how I thought this conversation was going to go, but I'm intrigued. I made the decision. I was like, this person maybe doesn't know that I'm trans, which I was still grappling with at the time, that I was like actually passing in society. And I told them, I was like, hey, just so you know, like I'm a trans woman. I don't think I'm allowed to play on your sports team. And they were like, honestly, we don't care. Like it's women's rugby. If you're crazy enough to try this, like we're going to take anybody, you know? And yeah, I went out to my first practice that Tuesday. I was terrified. I thought I was going to be ostracized. People were going to know 100% that I was trans or whatever. You know, that wasn't the case. People were super friendly. My coaches were extremely nice. And by Saturday of that week, you know, I was rostered and playing in my first match. I actually scored a try in my first game off a weird random bounce. Was completely terrified. I went in after one of the wingers had her nose broken in a high tackle.
Oh my God.
But after that, I chugged the boot at the end of the game and fell in love 100%.
That is community rugby. Grace is talking about maybe the middle of the pack, so a fair way from the Olympics. But she still felt the impact of a decision from World Rugby in 2019 to block trans women altogether.
They originally, in July of 2019, proposed banning trans women from the game at the elite levels, the highest levels of the game. So any international sanctioned competition doesn't necessarily have to be the Olympics, you know, the World Cup, Rugby Sevens internationally, what have you. They made the decision to ban trans women from the game. However, they made the decision to allow trans men to compete if they're willing to sign away basically all of their rights and liabilities for injury if they are to compete in the men's game. Which I found very interesting considering, you know, this decision was predicated on this idea of player welfare. Obviously, you know, cis player welfare, not trans player welfare. But I would say, you know, the decision is quite bizarre. It definitely changes my relationship with the sport. It makes me feel much less welcome. It makes me feel much more anxious. It definitely has put a bit of a damper on what was an extremely safe and supportive space for me. But I'm much more worried about the next generation of athletes who are going to see these rulings and not even take that invite, not even try the sport, you know, not even be a part of this amazing community because basically a bunch of cis white men who aren't connected to the women's rugby game made a decision based on politics and not based on science or evidence. And that's really heartbreaking to me because I can honestly say rugby probably saved my life. It gave me an immediate community overnight and it provided me with lifelong friends who are going to have my back through everything that I go through. And all I can wish is that that stays available to other people who are going to come after me.
When it made that call, World Rugby released a statement citing what it called the best available evidence, arguing that safety and fairness for cis women competing against trans women could not be assured. Is there any kind of physical advantage that you retain that you have over cisgendered women?
Based on the fact that I'm not like even close to being the best player on my team, I would find that quite shocking as somebody who's been athletic my entire life. But I think, you know, wading into the science and trying to find very clear biological determinist divisions between men and women is quite a futile exercise because biology, unfortunately, isn't that simple. There are women who produce unusually large amounts of testosterone. There are men who produce unusually, you know, small amounts. What the current regulation or the previous regulations basically did is they modulated hormone levels to basically bring trans women within what I describe as like the bell curve of cis female performance. And I think a lot of opponents of trans inclusion in sports say you can only play women's sports if you're the worst woman on the field after your transition, right? And I think that doesn't make a lot of sense. All I can say is that the experience I've had anecdotally where, you know, I've lost 3 to 4 grades off of my rock climbing, I've lost 1.5 minutes off of my sort of mile pace for running. You know, I used to be able to squat somewhere in the 150 to 180 pound range. I'm barely doing 100 now, you know, at my max. These are all things I've seen while continuing to stay physically active through my transition. It matches up with the actual peer-reviewed and solid science that we're seeing sort of slowly trickle out right now. I don't think I have a competitive advantage. I think I'm definitely a fast person. I'm not the fastest on my team. I would say I'm a pretty good kicker, but our fly half is a much better kicker than I am. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, I don't see myself winning any gold medals at the Olympics anytime soon.
Do you feel fairly confident that your participation in rugby at the community level has a future, or do you feel like even that could come under some sort of legal threat?
When it comes to my participation in the game, I'm going to play rugby until they pry the ball out of my dead hands, to be perfectly honest, and tell me that I can't. But I don't know. We have to be vigilant. You know, these things can trickle down. We're seeing that with England rugby right now. They're proposing rules for the community level of the game. But I'm just not going to stop fighting, and I'm not going to stop fighting for other sports as well, because 20 years from now, we're going to look back on this period, and people are going to think, how could we have treated a subset of human beings who already go through so much like that, you know? And history does bend towards justice in the long run.
That's The Signal for today. If you want to get in touch, our email is thesignal@abc.net.au, and we will be back in your feed tomorrow. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.